So welcome to the fourth episode of the Babe Lab podcast.
Hey!
The whole Babe Lab crew is here, and I'm drinking Heineken again. What are you guys doing?
Budweiser.
The king of beers.
Innocent Gun, oak-aged beer.
So what's that? I've never had that one.
Edinburgh Ale aged in oak barrels, traditionally used to mature malt whiskey. So it's pretty much whiskey.
Well, that's some of that. This sounds like scotch or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it tastes like scotch.
That's
oh, I'm sick.
Well, just take my word for it.
Yeah, it's good.
And I've got one of Bayman's Niagara Pale Ale.
First post.
Yeah.
All right. So, Richard Dawkins versus Francis Collins.
Does oh, this is my nonsense
yep.
once again. So, I got suckered into buying a Time magazine because... Of course, you know, our recent conversations about Richard Dawkins and his crazy movie, what's that called?
That's his book, The God Delusion, but
the one that was on Google.
The Root of All Evil.
The Root of All Evil, which is, of course, fundamentalist religion. But anyway, that's not even on. Have you guys noticed that it's not on? Like, did it get taken off, or did I just not find it? Like,
Google Video.
It was on Google Video, I watched it on Google Video, and then when I posted this, went back, and like, I think it's gone, but...
Weird.
Maybe I just couldn't find it, but I think maybe it's taken off. It's copyrighted or something.
Yeah.
Probably.
Google has some, like, hissy fit letters.
Whatever. I'm sure you can get it somewhere else pretty easily.
Yeah. But anyway, get that if you haven't seen it. That's, like, the prequel to this post. But yeah, anyway, I don't know. I found this... They basically had this head-to-head debate, and they had all these, like, pictures in the Time magazine, and, like, on the cover of, like... Francis Collins and Richard Dawkins, like, staring each other down. Like, they were about to start mud wrestling or something like that. But, yeah, they're just, you know, sitting around looking serious and, like, having this debate. So they had, like, they published some stuff from the debate and they threw up the quotes. So it was pretty funny and, I don't know, it was interesting. Actually, like, I thought Collins came across sort of better, like, even though I probably tend to, like, not agree as much with him. But I thought he was, like, pretty convincing with what he was saying. And
well, Dawkins is an extremist, right? Like,
yeah.
When you ask someone, say, like, what he's asking people to do, which is, like, give up their religion... You know, you're saying, what you're saying is, like, give up your, like, ridiculous, like, old beliefs. But, you know, that's what you want them to do. But what that you're asking them to do is, like, give up your family and, like, your
yeah.
tradition and your... I mean, it's a lot to ask of, like, a person, right? And I think you have to sort of take the... Well, yeah, I think, like, Collins has a better idea, even though, like, I disagree with a lot of things he says. But, like, you know, these things will gradually happen over time. And the destructive nature of, like, some of the fundamentalist religion stuff would be good to avoid, but I think it's pretty hard to, like... I was reading this thing this today, and this guy was talking about it, and he was like, Dawkins, even more extreme. He was like, these people are all crazy, they're, like, delusional. And he was saying, like, could you imagine if there is a bunch of people in the Middle East, and they have different interpretations of Shakespeare, and they're killing each other, and stuff like that. And he's like, well, how far off is that from what's going on? And, you know, you think about it, and really, like, to some people, like, it does seem pretty insane sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's the main point, is, like, it's always, like, it's great to, like, basically think whatever you want until it, like, you know, until you start trying to impose it on other people and, like, insist that they have to have the same belief if you're going to get along with them. You know, whatever that belief is, even if it's, like, a sort of a scientific belief, like, because there is, like, you know, in science, there's not everything is, like, you know, solid.
But you can be proved wrong with science, that's the difference.
Yeah. You can supposedly be proved wrong, but in science even, you get people who are convinced of certain things, or even people that are
but
convinced...
But a piece of data could suddenly convince them, whereas religion, it doesn't matter...
Well, that's the idea behind science,
yeah.
But like, you know, in general, like, you get people who are convinced one way or another of something. You know, even in science, even because science involves an interpretation of the data, right? So like, different people have different interpretations of the same data sometimes, and science, it's pretty common that people disagree.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, it's
within the field.
It's common
so,
in the forefront of science. I guess it's less common when you're talking about something like, you know, does the Earth revolve around the Sun, and like, is the Earth 6,000 years old? And,
oh, yeah, well,
you know, there's gradations of like, yeah, well, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's established things, but.
I think, like, Dawkins in his The Root of All Evil documentary, that's not actually his title.
Yeah.
So that was imposed by, like, the BBC or whatever, whoever, like, published his stuff. And that's not his original title. But
he wanted to call it Kill All the Cattle.
What was the original title?
I don't know. But I think he's really good like with his arguments, and he argues really well. And like for the most, I agree with him. Like, his weakest point is when he says that, you know, when he goes and says that most of the violence was caused by religion, which is probably not true, because like the biggest massacre that ever happened was like World War II and World War I.
Well, yeah, Stalin, Mao, China, like, yeah. I mean, those are all atheist killers, right? And like,
that's also, yeah, I mean, also like in the Nazi regime and stuff like that was also a misapplication of science in a way, right? Because everyone was really hardcore, like, yeah, natural selection, like, and they just, a lot of like different sort of fascist regimes took it to the extreme. And you know, even science take it to the extreme. Like, a scientific theory is not necessarily the final answer, and so you can take that to the extreme and impose it on people in negative ways too.
And like, and I guess, like, you know, there's a lot of violence associated with religion, but you know, I'm not a religious person, but like, there's a lot of good things come out of religion too. Like, one example is like the Katrina thing. Like, there was so much money given to the Katrina victims through like religious channels, and barely any from like, you know, scientific organizations. Like, what, you know, scientific organizations don't give to stuff like that. You know, like, there's things that happen because of it too.
I think that's actually like, you know, what keeps almost everybody who's religious coming back to it, even to this day, is like, you know, science can explain lots of things, but people still want to have like a book or like a bunch of people saying like,
yeah,
this is what you do
to
be a good person. Like, number one, number two, number three, you know, and people, like, people always want that. And part of like, people want to agree on things and have sort of a common,
yeah,
thing sometimes. I mean, you guys really run into problems when you have different groups that disagree on like what those things are and whatnot. But I don't know. I mean, that's one thing that, like, you know, we haven't replaced, I guess, is like that religion provides. So I don't know if anything alternative would ever come along.
It's all good.
It's the government's
problem. Dawkins is a sissy.
Next post.
Sissy time.
This is Borat's favorite.
Alright, so that's mine. Okay, I don't remember how I actually came across this one. It was like a website that showed like a bunch of different improbable research topics. One of which was the zipper entrapped penis. So apparently it's a common enough problem that people have written in the literature, how to unstick your penis from your zipper if you get stuck in there in the first place. And it's quite traumatic, both for the person that gets it stuck and the person that tries to get it out of there. And from what I read in the literature, there's all kinds of techniques you can use that involve mineral oil, pliers, and scissors. So there's a whole section of literature in PubMed. I found over 100 articles on how to get your dick out of your trousers.
Out of your zipper.
Out of your zipper, yeah. And, basically that's just it.
It's funny that there's that much. Like, I've never had that problem.
When I was small, you know those little, like, jump-em-in pajamas? You know, like the one-piecers? I zipped one of those babies up really fast. Oh, man.
Well, it's basically just natural selection anyway.
Yeah.
Right? Darwin Awards, Eureka.
I could have used that piece of knowledge.
I think with zippers out there now, like, there's probably selection against people with big penises. Like, I don't know, well, that's a hazard in general. Like, you think there must be an optimal penis size that's been selected, right?
Dude, that fits in the zipper? Penis size.
Like, I guess it's advantageous, like, in terms of usage and, like, you know, like, whatever, like, fertilization and stuff like that, but you know, if it's too long, like,
I don't know, mine hasn't been selected
take
yet,
a lot of
so.
What are you talking about? Well, you haven't tried to have kids yet after your zipper is dead.
Well, that's not surprising.
My dick gets stuck in my wheelchair.
Oh, man, well, Stephen Hawking is totally getting selected out. Say goodbye to your dream, mine.
Nuclear translation, that's you, Rob.
Oh, man.
Speaking of some crazy shiznit.
Yeah, I don't know, we've been talking about this a fair bit, just yapping away about sort of the primary round of translation, which is apparently specialized and, like, detects premature stop codons, and then the RNA goes through like nonsense mediated decay, which is somehow different. And I can't remember why we ended up talking about nuclear translation, but maybe it's possible that this preliminary round of translation occurs in the nucleus. And so, I don't know, there's just these people that have like been trying to find, like, there's evidence for ribosomes in the nucleus, and, you know, obviously there's mRNAs in there, and some of the initiation apparatuses and stuff like that, so...
I was just looking at a transcriptome paper today where, like, the majority, or at least 50%, greater than 50% of, like, RNA in the cell, period, like, never even leaves the nucleus.
Wow.
It's all about the nucleus.
So maybe it's just a post-transcriptional regulation where, you know, it doesn't leave the nucleus until it's actually needed. Mm. Or maybe there's protein being made in there, maybe. So, but the evidence for it is all, like, purification procedures, right? Like, getting all the nuclear and then showing that you can translate some mRNAs, some exogenous mRNAs. But, you know, the criticism is always, like, how do you know that your nucleus preppers are free ribosomes? I don't know, it just goes on and on. And so, there's like, yeah, the articles I posted on there sort of have some, you know, why there should be, what's the evidence for it, and so, yeah, one of the strangest things that I didn't really understand was, like, some people suggest that nuclear translation is necessary to explain nonsense-mediated decay, but I didn't really follow that argument, but anyways. I heard it about it a long time ago, and I was just wondering where the state of the art was, and it doesn't seem like it's actually gained general acceptance at all.
I just don't understand what the purpose would be.
So I think the idea is, like you're saying, with nonsense-mediated decay, like, there's a pioneer round, which is like a proofreading round.
Yeah.
And because all the factors that are required... Well, nonsense-mediated decay requires translation, I think is one observation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And because you have to detect you have to read to a premature stop codon, right?
You have to find that.
But nonsense-mediated decay happens in the nucleus. Or the factors for nonsense-mediated decay are in the nucleus or something like
that. Oh, yeah, is that the way it works?
So I think that implies as well that it's another sort of line of evidence that you have this pioneer round or something in the translation, and you have these factors that signal, you know, and the whole... It's like a proofreading round of translation that makes sure that the mRNA just does like a test run on the mRNA that...
Yeah.
Well, there's something like in the
nucleus
before it sends it out.
Yeah, before it sends it out for mass translation or whatever.
Yeah.
The problem is that we don't even know how, like, that decay happens. Like, we have no idea. We don't have a mechanism. We don't, like...
Mm. Oh, yeah?
Is that true?
So we suppose it's translation, but, like, have you ever read anything about how that operates?
I honestly haven't read very much on nonsense-mediated decay. I know it's a very complicated field, though, like...
Yeah.
It's interesting, the idea of, like, yeah, like, the fact that the cell is smart enough to recognize stop codons in the wrong place and, like, have this intricate method, supposedly, of, like, getting rid of that message. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it says they know somewhat about the mechanism of nonsense-mediated decay. So they know some of the players involved.
Oh, yeah?
So, yep.
And the fact that, it's interesting, too, like, these transcriptome, like, studies show that, like, basically, like, it's not, you don't just have, like, you know, a single ORF being produced, like, for a single gene. You have, like, all these overlapping transcripts coming off it and stuff like that. And so maybe it's this continual mechanism where you produce all these RNAs to, like, to all these almost random RNAs to produce lots of variety and lots of adaptability to the cell. And then, like, you have, like, this sort of test run of translation, like, in the nucleus. So that only the actual, you know, if you're producing all this random RNA, so that only the ones that actually can actually make a real protein and don't have premature codons actually, like,
it's just really energetically expensive to, like, do a protein every time, because you pretty much have to go all the way to the stop codon or something and then hydrolyze that protein. Like, what, do you have a proteasome in the nucleus to, like, get rid of all those proteins?
Exactly.
Do they accumulate in there? Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
all the more reason, though, to, like, eliminate it before it gets translated, like, you know, multiple times. And then translation is super, like, energy.
I do not care.
This podcast is like a black hole. I just cannot escape.
Where are we at?
Oh,
exposed.
Oh, we can skip that. Well, I mentioned something maybe about his post on the sea urchin. Like, that's pretty cool. Like, sequence, like, it's, been used a lot for, a lot of work on development has been done, but they actually never had the genome, which is crazy now to think about, you know, working on something without having a genome sequence available to you. But, I don't know, what I thought was most neat about that, well, first of all, it was, like, really similar, a lot more similar to us than you'd expect. Also, just how they did the study, like, they, you know, they published one of these massive papers, you know, which is, like, has a million authors, and, like, is really hard to get information out. But then they did a smart thing, which is, like, they took a whole issue, like, developmental biology at the same time, like, they took a whole issue and just dedicated it to, like, different labs, like, analyzed their little portion or their little piece of interest and, like, related it back to, like, you know, what the implications were from the recent sequencing and stuff like that. So I didn't look into too much detail at it, but, like, it's a cool way to do it, like, because you just, there's so much detail in these things that it's useful, like, it's cool to...
Oh yeah, it's always good to have, like, because then you can do all these mass genomic, like, things, and it just seems so powerful. But, so, I remember listening to something about, on a podcast, and they were talking about, like, the evolution of these things, and apparently they're fairly related to people, like, in terms of wherever they are. I can't even remember what subgroup or whatever they are, but, and, like, why were they initially used as, like, model organisms? It's the size of their eggs or something, or what is it?
There's
a reason why they're model organisms.
It's easy to watch the development, like, after the sperm and egg, like...
Yeah, I think they lay, like,
they're
a billion eggs
transparent,
at a time
transparent
or something.
Embryos.
Transparent embryos, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And they're the most basic deuterosome, right?
Deuterosomes, that's what it is.
Deuterosome!
That's how they're related to people, somehow.
Stone, right?
What was crazy about this, too, is they had, like, they found all these, like, rhodopsin genes and, like...
Yeah,
all
these,
like, things
cool
that are, yeah,
sensory genes, and they don't have eyes or nose.
Or, yeah, or ears or whatever.
It's pretty cool. It just shows you, like, the plasticity of genes, too, right? That they can, like, you know.
The other cool thing is apparently they've got really complex immune systems.
Yeah,
this guy was talking
cool
on the Nature podcast, and saying that basically they've got, like, a whole whack of receptors that, like, find little bits of bacteria and things like that. So there's a whole library of, like, innate immune system that we might be able to use pharmaceutically eventually.
It's crazy to think that maybe you can just, like, take the same, almost the same bag of genes, you know, rearrange the networks and, like, shuffle them around how they work, and then, like, you know, you can make a sea urchin and you can shuffle them around, you can, like, make a person or something, you know, maybe we're just basically all the same genome shuffled around different ways. Like.
But one of the scientists that discovered the Hox genes famously said that if she had control over the Hox gene expression, she could turn a mouse into a giraffe.
That's, like, that's the next experiment, though. Like, I always thought it'd be cool, too, like, you know, because, like, you know, we have, like, an evolutionary theory about how species emerge and stuff like that. Like, we've never seen it in action. Like, and obviously, you know, presumably the main idea is that it takes too long to see or whatever, but, like, I don't know. You could speed it up in the lab, theoretically, if you knew everything about what made species different. You could just turn one into another, like, or modulate the developmental process, like, exactly what you're saying.
Just mass mishmashing of genomes together and see what you come up with.
Yeah, that's the ultimate proof of evolution.
Sounds a little sketchy.
And would prove that scientists are God.
Next post!
What
is it?
Should I talk about?
Cell phones brain cancer?
Okay, cell phones give you brain cancer. Maybe.
Oh, just a minute, I think the cell phone.
I think my tumor's growing.
Yeah, by the way, my heart, my processor is feeling really warm on my lap.
Yeah.
Apparently laptops, like, decrease your sperm count.
For really?
Apparently cell phones do, too.
Cell phones?
Yeah, I was
really
reading something recently about cell phones and reduced fertility in men. So you better watch it, Bob.
I think it's just all an association. People use cell phones as stress and they don't produce sperm or something.
That's why I don't have a cell phone.
It's like smoking and lung cancer. It's all just some sort of correlation. Yeah, anyways, yeah, so, like, there's a bunch of studies. Actually, I can't believe how well it's studied, like, the link between brain cancer and cell phone use. I guess largely because there's such a huge sample size and stuff. I mean, there's so much data out there, I guess, available.
There's all kinds of urban myths. This is one
yeah
that I heard about somebody having the logo of the cell phone imprinted in the tumor.
Well, yeah, or, you know, using two cell phones to hard-boil eggs and stuff like that, like, which are
Did you know that? Like, was
is that total crap? Because
yeah,
I heard it on the radio.
Yeah. I've heard it before, but I looked it up. Like, I was probably at Snopes or one of these, you know, urban legend debunking sites.
Yeah,
apparently it's a little crap.
Yeah, that does sound.
Well, like, technically, your radar antenna, like, that's how we discovered microwaves. Like, microwave oven, it's because these microwave antennas, and, like, this repair guy noticed that there was never any snow around, like, microwave antennas. Like,
oh,
and
wow.
Then, like, figured out that we can make ovens with them or whatever. But
has to be.
Yeah, but I think the output of a cell phone
it's probably
not
way
enough
too
to,
low,
like,
yeah.
You know,
so
apparently it's enough to cook your brain.
Is there any mouse studies on that? Like, where they, like, strap a cell phone to a mouse and, like, watch it get tumors?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a test that needs to be done instead of, like, these, like, human ones. Yeah, these big correlative studies. Because, like, so apparently they haven't been able to find really a correlation between cell phone use and brain cancer. But, like, they have found significant incidence of if you do have to use a cell phone and you use it on your right-hand side of your head, it's going to be on your right-hand side of your head. Like, the tumor is more likely to be on the same side you use your cell phone, which they just leave to, like, it's just a recall bias by, like, the patient. So, I don't know. Mice just seem so much more controlled, right?
But except for the fact that everything gives mice cancer, so...
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, I was just wondering if it was, like, there was a more general phenomenon, and I came across, actually, like, it seems like there's a fair bit of consensus that electrical workers, like, of a whole bunch of sorts, like, people who work making chips and telecommunications workers, like, even people that operate telegraphs, apparently, like, sometimes have been found to have increased brain tumor risk.
Brain tumors specifically, eh?
Brain tumors mostly, yeah.
Wow.
And then...
Well, like, yeah, leukemia is a big one, though, too, right?
Leukemia
like,
is, yeah, they saw that one.
Around power lines and stuff
yeah.
like that.
And some breast cancer stuff, too, so... Makes you wonder about, you know, all the radiation that we're walking around in.
So I got to hear about, like, wireless power, apparently, recently. Has anyone else heard this?
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Is that just, like, a load of crap, or what?
I don't know. I don't know enough about it, but...
I
read somewhere that they wanted to, like, put, like, solar panels on the moon or something and, like, radiate back the power to Earth. Like a focus beam, like a laser, but of, like, microwave.
Like
microwave
a million
radiation.
Of your solar panels?
Yeah, like Rob's
got
the only thing I own.
The only thing he has. You can't take that away from him.
Next post.
Oh, yeah, the radio.
That was a funny post.
I love the radio analogy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
From Jordi Lesbnik.
Yeah, so I came across this... what was I reading?
Cancer cell.
Oh, alright. So I came across this cancer cell. And basically just...
Cell
was that? Was that from Hawking?
I'm just wondering why you're reading cancer cell.
Oh, yeah. So it's just an analogy, what the point he was trying to make is, can a biologist fix a radio? He was making parallels between the way biologists, like, go to solve a problem versus the engineer kind of way to solve a problem. I would say that probably biologists, if the radio wasn't working, they would probably, like, open it and, like, and then categorize all the components by their color and their size and, you know, break it apart. But then, you know, it doesn't tell you much. Like, once you have the size and, like, the color of the component, you can't fix the radio yet. So they'd probably need, like, multiple radios. And each radio would take one component out until they find, you know, the one component that when you take it out, the radio doesn't work anymore. And they would call that, you know, the main functional component or something.
Yeah.
Until somebody else finds another component that when you take it out, it doesn't work anymore. But basically his point was that, like, that by doing it that way, you never really figure out how the whole network works. Because by taking individual components out, like, you could never figure out how it works as a whole and quantitatively. And he was contrasting that to engineers, where you just show them, like, a picture or a design of, like, a circuit, and they'll know right away, because there's, you know, there's, like, standardized writing for different components, and they're quantitative, like, this is a resistor, it's, like, it's 15 ohms or whatever, and, like, any engineer can understand how, like, a device that he has never seen works, because the way the information is, like, passed on. Whereas we are, like, a little bit all over the place. Like, our diagrams are, like, arrows, clues and stuff like that that go between boxes, but they're really non-quantitative.
Totally non-quantitative.
You're totally right. There should be a better standard. Like, they have the arrow, and then you're forgetting they have the block arrow.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the block arrow.
So there's basically the two symbols we have. So there should be, yeah, definitely more symbols. And, like, symbols
more,
that
symbols.
More, like, things that represent complexes, and there should be, like, yeah, a thing for, like, if anybody knows KDEs or anything, they should be on the, like,
yeah,
thing for sure. But at his point, like, is kind of silly in a way, though. Like, exactly, a radio is engineered. So
yeah,
it's totally different, right? Like, a cell is basically produced by, like, a bunch of random happen chances that work well.
Yeah, like, it's
so,
funny to think, like, you
this
know,
is like
what
intelligent
about,
design, right?
What if you had a radio, but a radio that was assembled, that was self-assembled from a bunch of parts that, like,
yeah, yeah,
randomly
yeah,
happened to bump into each other?
Yeah, it's like,
you know, hey, let's make a radio.
That is a classic, like the blind walk.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Exactly. It's a
Dawkins
classic.
Yeah.
And so I think his example is pretty flawed, because the way a radio is built is for a specific function, and it was thought about ahead of time, and, like, a cell is just not the same.
But actually, in the article too, like,
but he makes some good points.
He goes beyond the radio thing too, and he sort of suggests that, like, the biology, basic biology approach is, like, fatally flawed, and, like, how we go through these cycles, like, repetitive, basically, cycles. Like, I guess we kind of advance our knowledge, but, like, basically repetitive cycles where, like, we think we have something cool, and then we just, you know, can't really figure it out. Forget
so
about
we move
it.
On. Yeah.
And we come back to the same thing again, again, again.
After 20 years, we come back to it.
And he sort of suggests, like, I don't remember all this stuff, but he sort of suggests that it was fundamentally, like, a property of how biology is done, as opposed to something like physics, where, you know, you have a quantitative mathematical language. And I think that's the thing, biology is, like, we've never, basically, I think, because we've never had the tools. It's kind of cool that now, for the first time, people are starting to actually do that stuff in biology, and set up quantitative experiments that they can measure and, you know, make a mathematical model.
I can fix your radio with my mouth.
Well, there you go. Stephen Hawking is well, he's a mathematician. So,
next post. Shall we? Oh, health map. Check it out. It's pretty cool. What's the URL? The URL is healthmap.org. Check it out. So, like, I just
went out right now.
So I did just check it out right now.
Who's got the flu?
And there's a syphilis outbreak
Are you
in
on
Vancouver.
That? Oh, is that you?
Yeah, it's got me right there. I've got the flu. I'm all mapped out.
Yeah.
Anyways, check it out. It's like Google Maps, and they've got, like, all the outbreaks as reported by mainstream media mapped out on superimposed upon Google Maps, which is ridiculous because they should be using Google Earth, obviously, so that you can, like, zoom
so
in and see it all 3D and.
You can see, like, the virus particles and treatment.
Yeah, I mean, they need to, like, up the ante a bit on it, but at the same time, it is pretty cool, and it's apparently totally automated. It's super up-to-date. I mean, I guess the last one in Canada is the 16th of November, but still, that's not too
that's
bad.
That's awesome. There's only, like, 3 sick people in North America.
No, that's the problem with it, though. It's, like, all the Western Europe is so overrepresented because of the density of countries. It's all countries. So, like, the points in Canada are actually on Ottawa. So hopefully they pick that up. Because, like, you click on the Ottawa thing, and it's like, health officials warn of syphilis in Vancouver. And you're like, Vancouver is, like, across the other side of the continent. But anyways, it's still, yeah, hopefully they
no, it's a great
get
idea.
A little better resolution, but it's good.
It's because of all those hippies in BC.
The syphilis?
Yeah.
Oh, man, like, I'm just checking out Africa, like, wow, don't go there, like...
It's
shit.
All, like, cholera and stuff.
I wouldn't have known, like, but... anthrax, livestock.
Holy shit.
Ebola.
Wildlife, Namibia.
Ebola on one of the clicks I just hit on, like, in Western Africa.
Shaik in the stink after prison outbreak.
Well, we've been getting all those...
Sounds like a TV show or something.
Prison break.
Those emails at the hospital about this norovirus outbreak that we were talking about before. We thought maybe you had Norwalk Rob and we're...
I've been sick for one day.
I'm pretty sure I had Norwalk, like, a couple weeks ago.
But that's not on the map. The and you can actually specifically select Norwalk.
Yeah,
virus,
I just...
It's our hospital outbreak's not on the map. It's a total hoax.
Oh.
They're just trying to boost Purell sales.
Yeah.
I just can't wait till, like, this is, like, a self-diagnostic tool. So you can go and, like, find yourself and be like, what do I have? Like, it's reported before you even know what you have.
No, that's the future.
Yeah, that's the future for sure.
Oh, next post is about Dave's extra nipple.
Oh, I was
gonna. You like totally sold it. First of all, I'm anonymous coward. Yeah.
So right. Yeah, I guess. Do you want to go over this one, the third nipple? There's
why not?
Not much.
Later.
Yeah. So basically, this stemmed from a fellow babe lover who will remain anonymous, even though he's not totally just moved his.
Even though he's a coward. Oh, no,
claiming he had a third nipple, which you know he was good enough to at least show us. So I decided to take it upon myself to look it up. And checked out the literature on polyphilia, it's called, or supernumerary nipples. So apparently, it can be like it's quite a range that you can have from like a patch of hair to a full blown extra breast, which is polymastia. So think Total Recall.
Oh yeah.
Some other facts I came across: it's more common in women than men. But they're only diagnosed in about 2% of the female population, although, I mean, how often somebody gets diagnosed for that is pretty sketchy. So, but I thought the funniest thing that I came across was that Alexander Graham Bell actually did some third nipple research.
Third nipple research.
So in addition to inventing the telephone, he was also successful in raising sheep with multiple extra nipples through selective breeding, which suggested a dominant inheritance pattern. So he was a Scot, and working with sheep is probably right up his alley, so that's just true.
Check out, if that's an extra nipple, I think I have 100.
But, check this guy.
That's quite different than the other ones.
Whoa.
It can basically look like a mole.
Yeah, it looks like a tiny mole.
That just looks like a dark spot.
Yeah,
I think like what defines it is if it falls on the milk line, which basically runs from your armpit down to your groin, like through your regular nipple. So a mole on your back is not an extra nipple, but one.
Yeah, like these look like the arrangement, like on that pig, for example.
I seriously think I have 100.
100 nipples.
I want to set a
we should call it Guinness.
Yeah.
Can you induce something? Was it you that was saying you can induce lactation in males?
So
would that be the true test of the ultimate?
Oh yeah.
So like extra nipple, if it makes milk, it's a nipple, right?
I don't know when your extra nipple, but when your regular nipple. Apparently, this suckling stimulus, if it's persistent enough, so if there's suckling like every day for like 2 months, you'll actually start lactating even though you're a guy.
Really?
Oh god.
That's what
we
I
need
read.
Some more research on this. Like, oh man.
That sounds like a future post.
That sounds like a good science video. Speaking of extra nipples, check out that pig.
That is a nice pig. Next post again is mine, Aubrey de Grey. did anyone watch it? I finally got around to watching the thing, and it was awesome.
It was wicked. It was so funny.
Yeah, it was funny. I think is what I'd give it more than anything else.
More than informative.
He's a pretty good speaker though.
He's a good speaker.
He talks fast. Keeps it going.
I like that.
Very he's talking as opposed to like the slides just kind of like have something funny, whereas he's just talking at you.
Yeah, I liked, and he comes off as pretty arrogant.
Yeah.
Like, especially in the questions.
Yeah.
And, which were pretty humorous, you can talk about them. And, but yeah, just the way he brushes aside the biologies, in that talk, it was ridiculous. Like, I don't know, I guess maybe it was his target audience was not biologists, I guess, maybe for that talk. But
well, he's also not a biologist. Too, right?
Yeah, but he says he knows about this stuff.
Yeah.
He even challenges people in the audience. If you think you know better than me, come up and tell me, I'll prove you wrong. Or something. He says something like that to this target audience of people who are in the tech industry or something. I can't remember what. But anyways, still, I think it's still worth a watch because it is true that he does have a good point in some of the things about prolonging the lifespan and stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, I think in the biology, I think it's not his area of expertise, and he does try to talk about it. Maybe he shouldn't talk about it, but I think actually his main point, and I think maybe why he talks about the biology, but his main point is not about whether we can cure aging or not, but whether we should look at it and whether we should research that and whether we should justify research on the basis of we're going to try and cure aging. Because maybe, because I think it's true, you can't, what everybody... What it's easy to attack him on is because he steps out and says, we can cure aging, and we can do this, this, and this, and this, and these are the causes of aging, and we can cure them.
The seven causes of aging?
Yeah.
The seven consequences of aging that he's defined? Yeah.
Yeah, so it's easy to disagree and be like, you're wrong. Like, you're not a biologist, and you can't, you haven't proven that that's true. And that's, you know, that's fine, but we haven't really, we don't probably know enough about biology to say one way or another whether or not we can cure aging. And there's lots of other diseases that we invest lots of money in with the idea of curing them.
But aging is not a disease.
Right? Well, he argues that it is a disease. That's his point, right?
Depends on how you define disease, right? Like, if you define it as something that kills you, you know, that aging
or impairs you.
But who dies of aging? You die of,
some
like,
sort of failure associated
with a disease of some sort. Well, that's like semantics,
I mean, when you
right?
die of old age, it's like a system failure, but it's not, I don't know if you'd call it a disease, or something. Like, it's not necessarily cancer.
Sure, sometimes you can, you can die of something that's somewhat undefined, but I'm for sure there's a root cause behind it. Your heart fails, or something, you know, it's not like...
Yeah,
it's,
but it's
not
just
like
a broader definition that includes lots of diseases. Like, cancer, we think of as one disease, but you could also classify it into, like, 100 different diseases, if you wanted to, right?
But
they all have a common feature.
And you almost have to, because it's so heterogeneous that you can't, like, you can't, well, so far, like, the idea of curing cancer with a silver bullet is kind of
well,
by the wayside,
clinic,
right?
It's treated the same way. Like, basically, it's viewed as cancer as cells that proliferate too much, and we give basically chemotherapeutics and other things that are supposed to destroy cells that proliferate too much, right? So...
That's the current treatments, but if you look at the future of therapeutics in cancer, they're all targeted towards, like, breast cancer and prostate, you know, like, they're coming out with specialized treatments.
But then on the other hand, too, like, they also, you could also, if you group them that together, you can also, like, define common causes, right? So, like, there are a lot, there are a few finite number of causes that cause cancer, so if you were to look at cancer that way, and then say, let's try and prevent cancer, you might be able to prevent all cancers in the same way, and that's, like...
Yeah,
I think
true.
He's arguing is let's look at all the common things about aging and, like, can we do some pretty small number of things maybe that would prevent all the, you know, all the, like, diseases that are the end result of aging sort of, you know, as this blanket. This broad group. I don't know.
It'd be interesting to see if he manages to get a bunch of money, basically.
Yeah.
And so he's offering the Methuselah Prize for the long mouse, which we talked about before, and, like, where's he getting that money from?
Some co-founder of Apple and a bunch of, like, different private investors.
Oh, yeah, okay. Huh.
Well, even just, I mean...
I am going to smack some sense in that bitch.
Considering how much money we invest in things, you know, like, how much money, you know, has been invested, say, in trying to find a vaccine for HIV, and there's no indication, there's no scientific reason to think that that is possible. There's no evidence that it's possible. And there's, like, people, like, we talked about last time, like, what's his name? The guy, you know, David Baltimore, who works on this stuff and that, like, is now saying it's impossible. So, you know, I mean, why not try it for aging, right? I mean, I guess it's just, you can't argue that, like, saying that you can't cure a disease is not a good reason for not researching to try and cure it, because you're trying to predict the future.
Yeah, I mean,
sort of his argument.
Yeah, I think, like, and it also his argument was kind of like, well, we know how to do this and we know how to do that, and so we should basically be putting all these things together to, like, cure aging. So, like, he's basically admitting the fact that aging is, like, a bunch of separate different things already. So why don't we still be looking at these things individually? So what? There's going to be a bunch of money thrown at a bunch of people who are just going to use a combination of a bunch of different other discoveries to, like, come up with what, a drug regimen that you should be on or something? Like, I don't know, what's the new science?
Like, we already know the drug regimen.
What's the new science that's going to come out of funding this guy? What exactly are you going to be looking at when you're trying to cure aging? What exactly are you going to be studying?
Well, you're studying what's common to, say, cancer, Alzheimer's.
We already know what's
and stuff, and what are the common causes, and what can we do to prevent these things from happening in the first place, as opposed to waiting till those things to happen, at which point they're probably mostly irreversible. And say when you get cancer, even if you could cure cancer, you know, mostly people are very old, and probably the next year they're going to get Alzheimer's, and then you cure that, and then 5 years later they get some other disease, and you're trying to attack all these diseases. You know, maybe if we researched aging and the root causes that are common, then maybe we could, you know, have a regenerative stem cell therapy that would just replace our stem cells periodically, and, you know,
so
that would be, for example, one blanket solution to the whole thing. Maybe we would come out with a group. You know, maybe we wouldn't, but...
This is hard on a, like, if you're doing everything reductionist style, it's pretty hard to, like, like, you know, define a research project that is going to be trying to cure aging? Like, are you just going to be throwing a bunch of stuff at it? Like, are you just going to try stem cells? You know, I'm going to try stem cells.
Well,
know,
no, but
like,
I mean, you just look, it's like Tony's been saying, you know, the root cause, like, I mean, right now,
yeah.
It's like, is it, you know, radical damage, or is it, you know, like, what is the cause? And then, so you find that out, and then you can, you know, put off, or, you know, prevent radical damage, or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, cause, like, increase longevity that way.
Yeah.
Or
and
I'm
then,
I mean,
then
you
at,
will, like,
yeah.
eventually run into, you know, like, the health span versus lifespan thing, but,
yeah.
I mean, these are things that you can look at, and, you know, so what are the underlying causes of growing old?
Yeah,
but,
or like,
how can you, you know, interact with those, like, pathways or whatever and improve outcomes?
And a lot of those things
yeah.
that, like, probably scientifically there are good reasons to think are involved in aging. Like, you know, people seem to think that, you know, I don't know much about the field, but people say, like, mitochondrial DNA damage is part of the aging process. That's totally under research. Like, you know, how many people look at the mechanisms compared to how many people look at, you know, super high doses of, yeah, the effect of super high doses of radiation on p53 cancer cells. Like, there's lots of other things out there maybe too that could benefit.
Yeah, you might you're right. It might fund some, like, sort of ignored parts of research that have to do with aging that, yeah, no, I can see that for sure.
I think we need to do comparative biology. There are some organisms that live a long time, like turtles, and there's some fish that, like, live for hundreds of years. What about trees? Like, what makes trees, like, live so long? Like, what is it that's different?
They're cold-blooded. They don't, like, have
to... no-blooded.
Yeah, they don't have to eat, like, a bunch of, like, other stuff. And
but,
like,
yeah, but maybe it's the fact that, like, any of these cells, like, from the tree can pretty much make a new tree. Like, basically all their cells are stem cells.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they live so long. Maybe, you know, maybe there's something fundamental to, like, long-lived organisms that we can figure out using comparative biology.
Well, now that
but
we
then if you take all mammals,
there,
like, apparently, like, lifespan is, like, correlates with body size.
Heartbeat.
And, yeah, heartbeat, that's what it is.
Lifespan correlates really well with heartbeat in mammals.
So, you know, there's something fundamental about mammalian lifespan. I don't know
yeah.
if we could relate that to trees and fish and, yeah. But anyways, yeah, that's a good idea, too.
Either way, you know, anti-aging research should not be solely the field of cosmetic companies.
Next post.
What do we have? Oh!
Holy fucking shit.
He's just throwing in some explicit tag stuff.
That's right. Yeah. Next post.
Up to the reputation.
Next post is mine. Strange diseases of the women. And one is Laura that sent me a link and I had to put it on because it was just too funny. And the other one, it's one of my friends that sent me an email. And they're both psychological disorders, one of which is called reverse delusional misidentification syndrome, and that happens when, let's say, a woman thinks that all of a sudden she's turning into a man. And in this particular case, a patient that was schizophrenic, and apparently she had atrophic vaginitis, but she thought she would, like, whatever she was experiencing was, like, her clitoris was turning into a penis, and her ovaries were turning into testes, and she thought she was undergoing transformation or something. So there's actually a syndrome that, like, relates to that kind of feeling that's actually researched out there. And the other one, which is even more interesting, is the persistent sexual arousal syndrome. So this is kind of hilarious. It's a I think partly an urban myth, partly a real thing. And in Japan, it's all the rage right now.
It's all the rage. Disorder is all the rage right now.
Every Alexander Graham Bell studied that as well.
Other
nipples and aroused women.
So which one of these was the Laura one? The vaginitis or the...
The reverse delusional misidentification syndrome, she sent me. But so this Japanese thing is called iku-iku-bio, which means cum-cum disease. Basically, it's like these women that get orgasms all the time without any stimulation or any desire for anything sexual. And apparently it's really disruptive. Like,
them or for, like, the people around them.
They're kind of working and sleeping. You know, like. But just imagine, like, I don't even know if this is applicable to men, but, like, how damaging that could be. I mean, if you're firing off at every minute, like...
Oh, could you imagine if that's... Like, what would you do if suddenly your girlfriend is like, turning into a man. You'd be like, okay, see, that's a bit of a turn-off.
So, what
a penis.
What happens if they both happen at the same time when your girlfriend's like, I'm getting erections all the time?
But if your girlfriend, yeah, is like, I'm turning to like a man, you'd just be like, oh yeah, I want to turn into a woman.
That's cool.
What about your girlfriend?
Or you just start like frantically like figuring out how to like induce yourself to be a woman.
So, interestingly, this is
lactation.
Constant suckling. Get a breast pump and hook up that third nipple. Yeah, so this persistent sexual arousal syndrome can arise when you get off your SSRI medication. So those are like your antidepressant pills. And so it's been known that some
of these... I think I have that. I thought it was like my processor or like my laptop.
Some of these antidepressant pills, I think... Paxil or whatever. Like when you're on it, apparently your libido is like way down. So I think it's just offshooting on the other side once you get off.
Oh yeah, probably. That's probably what it is.
Offshooting for sure. Or shooting off.
But apparently like it's also related to soy intake and menopause and traumatic
soy intake?
Yeah, so maybe that's why all these Japanese chicks are like persistently aroused.
There's a whole bunch of Japanese chicks that are
persistently
aroused.
I knew there was something in that bubble tea.
That
was some messed up bubble tea.
You had some messed up bubble tea recently?
I don't want to talk about that.
If you would like to listen to more of this bullshit, check out part 2 of episode 4 and leave.